Welcome to People More Interesting Than Me, the podcast, where I step back and let fascinating individuals take the spotlight. Join me as I sit down with incredible guests who captivate and inspire, showcasing their stories, experiences, and wisdom that make them truly extraordinary. Tune in for engaging conversations that'll leave you enlightened and entertained. I mean, at least I'm entertained. This week, we have the privilege of delving into the extraordinary journey of James. James is not the average individual. Formerly entrenched in the world of finance, he found himself grappling with depression, alcohol abuse, and a profound sense of aimlessness. But in 2017, everything changed. In a moment of clarity and bravery, he walked away from his career, setting forth on a path of self-discovery and purpose. His journey led him to the realm of psychedelics, where he underwent a profound transformation from participating in his first ayahuasca ceremony to becoming a seasoned psychedelic guide. Join us as we uncover the incredible story of James, a beacon of inspiration and change in a world hungry for transformation. Enjoy. So, you're currently in Colorado, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you are I'll try to get them all this time. Psychedelic coach, transformers coach, men's coach. Which ones am I missing?
Psychedelic policy advocate, community builder. Those are the main branches.
Okay. So how do you even start to get into that? Like, can you kind of tee us up on that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I look at all of this really as a deep unfolding. My nature and my disposition and my own human persona really set me up to be in a position to step in and do this work. It wasn't something that here's one piece of education that I need to get. It wasn't like a classic traditional educational sort of stepping stone to get to. It was actually something that just sort of fell into my lap naturally. And in a lot of ways, I even resisted it as it was falling into my lap. And again, I think my natural disposition just sets me up to be a person who can hold space for people and be a guide and a steward and be sensitive enough to feel where people are at in their life's journey and how to support them in various different ways. Kind of flash back to 2017, I started sitting with plant medicine for myself and my own journey. And I was called to that space because I had suffered from depression, anxiety, just disconnection from life and purpose. I felt like I was just sort of a leaf in the wind, directionless, uncertain of where I should go next. And I watched a documentary in probably 2011 called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. It was a film about DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is a psychedelic. And it's a psychedelic that a compound that essentially they call it like the God particle or the God molecule, right? Like if you put it in layman's terms, it's like the light at the end of the tunnel. It's like the part of, it shows us sort of the light of God, if you will. And so, that really struck my curiosity because it felt like there was something in that that created meaning. Like there was some deeper meaning that I really wanted to explore. So plant medicine entered my life in 2017, and I sat in my first ceremony and, had big breakthroughs and big experiences that helped me heal from some things that had been holding me back and helped me deal with my depression better, my anxiety better. And then about probably, a year and a half into sitting regularly, the co-facilitator asked me to step in as a co-facilitator. And that's really when the work began for me. It's where my gifts in life started to really show up. And so from there, it was just this, again, just an unfolding layer by layer. Like, this is the next opportunity. Okay, great. Step into it. And then another opportunity came up and I just kept saying yes to the things that, made me feel like I was stepping into, you know, a meaning and purpose and authority. And and then I guess 7 years later, I find myself kind of right in the middle of, you know, what's happening here in Colorado with regard to psychedelics.
And when you say plant medicine specifically, what is the scope of that? Like, what does that fall under? Like, when you say that, what is like kind of the main, I guess you would you say drugs? Like, what are the main ones that falls under, and what's the criteria of that?
So when I say plant medicines, I'm really speaking about the psychedelic variety. Kind of the classic ones that, you know, are emerging in, you know, the kind of lexicon right now are psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, when the psychedelic compound in ayahuasca is DMT, dimethyltryptamine. And then there's a couple other plant medicines that are called, they're kind of categorized as plant medicines, but they come from other sources. Mescaline is the psychedelic compound in like San Pedro, Wachuma, and then another one that's kind of coming online is ibogaine, which is a African root bark, and each one of them sort of has their own different, you know, characteristics and spirits and applications, and but the, you know, the most common one is magic mushrooms, certainly, but the ceremonies, the plant medicines that I was sitting in the early years were ayahuasca ceremonies.
Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong. Ayahuasca ceremonies is originally from Peru. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it really originates from this area of Peru called the Sacred Valley. But then it spread, you know, to various other regions of South America. The Brazilians have a practice in their Christian church, and it's a daime practice. So they call it daime. It's a sacrament that they use to commune with, you know, their God. And then, you know, Colombians have their own version. Ecuadorians have their own version, and it sort of traveled up into Costa Rica and you know, made its way, you know, to America.
No, that's awesome. And have you dealt with any, like shrooms, because that just legalized for medical treatment in Colorado, right? Or am I wrong on that?
Yeah, in November 2022, we passed a ballot measure that decriminalized plant medicines, the four that I just spoke about, and also established a legal framework for licensed facilitation of plant medicines. And first, it's going to start with magic mushrooms next year. And then there's an option to work in the other substances if the model that's created can support those medicines in a legal framework. So effectively, the decriminalization of those substances, you know, it basically reprioritizes possession as like below liability of jaywalking. So it's below jaywalking, essentially. That's how the government can't commit any resources to prosecuting possession, small mm-hmm. possession. So the what remains illegal is the sale of those substances. So you can't engage in commerce of those substances. Okay. From the seller side.
That makes complete sense. I mean, that actually that sounds like the most logical. That's awesome.
No, it's really measured and intelligent. And it's, you know, been driven by the voters. I mean, the decriminalization movement in the United States has by and large been ballot measures. Some of them have gone through state legislatures or city municipality systems. But the voters have really been pushing it forward, and it's intelligent in a lot of ways, because then, you know, you data and the data that we're seeing in Denver, is, you know, that like the things that people are afraid of happening with, you know, decriminalization aren't happening. You're not seeing a rise in crime. You know, you're not seeing an exorbitant amount of, like, you're not really seeing any DUIs almost. Like, all those statistics that people would probably be worried about with decriminalizing drugs, it's just really, you know, not happening. So it writes the story, you know, that that's true here, is that, like, for the most part, it's like these substances are relatively safe when we compare them to, you know, these other substances, like, say, alcohol or heroin or methamphetamines. And then also too, you know, we're starting to see all the upside in the research that's coming online, and then all the anecdotal stories that are kind of becoming popular across social media platforms.
Yeah, let's dig into that a little bit. So what would you say, who would you say the larger groups are that this is going to be advantageous for, at least for, like, therapy?
You know, if you zoom out far enough, it's going to be really impactful for the broad range of the population. But when we look at, when I look at the mental health statistics in America, you know, it's frightening. A lot of people are living with depression, anxiety, PTSD, and various other, you know, maladies or, you know, issues that maybe aren't noticeable, but are still, you know, issues. And so, you know, looking at some of these diagnosable conditions, if you will, depression, you know, is the way that I've kind of come to understand depression. When, you know, when Prozac was created, it was created in the 90s, and there was a big marketing campaign around that time that for Prozac, that said that depression is a chemical and is the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain. And it's classically been called chemical imbalance theory. And so antidepressants or SSRIs are there to treat the chemical imbalance within the brain, right? And so that's the assumption, is that it's a chemical imbalance. So the SSRIs and antidepressants treat that assumption. And the research that started coming out in the late 2000s, maybe early 2000s, was that chemical imbalance theory is kind of inconclusive. It doesn't really encapsulate what is totally happening within the brain. And with the, you know, the amount of research that's starting to be done on psilocybin within the brain and as a treatment for depression, one of the emerging arguments against chemical imbalance theory is that depression is actually the absence of optimal neuroplasticity within the brain. So to say that the brain isn't creating a healthy amount of new connections. Antidepressants have been doing then is that they've been essentially creating they've been creating some neuroplasticity in the brain, but that's why it only works for SSRIs and antidepressants really only work for about 67% of the population, somewhere in there. And through these studies with psilocybin, we're seeing that people with major depressive disorder or any kind of depression really there's about a 90 to 95% treatment rate, where about 90 to 95% of those people are seeing success with the treatment of their depression with psilocybin. So it's a more effective way of treating depression and also, you know, kind of similar to anxiety as well, really good with that. And then PTSD is sort of in its own arena because it's more of a trauma. So there's some kind of brain body disconnection that happened in a traumatic episode or within complex post-traumatic stress disorder, repeated disconnections from the mind and the body. And I see, you know, these plant medicines are really opening up the connection to the mind and body and helping people heal beyond their PTSD by essentially resourcing the brain with new neural connections that allows them to develop beyond the trauma that they have been stuck in.
That was amazing, because I'm going to put this in in layman's terms, the way I hear it. So basically, it leads me to give a man fish, he'll eat for a day, and then give a man obviously a fishing line. So the way I see that is antidepressants are going to help you today as long as you keep taking them over and over again. But obviously, with some of these plant medicines, I can only imagine you're kind of reprogramming kind of your neural networks and kind of revamping it where you don't really need obviously antidepressants all the time. Is this something that kind of, I was going to ask this earlier, but like say you're taking it some type of plant-based medicine for an extended period of time. Is there a certain point where I know that a lot of people, you know, like you go to therapy. It's not like something you finish with. Is this something at some point you get to, you're done with it? I know that not every case is the same, but would you see it as strengthening your brain? Because when you mess in plasticity, I think of the opposite word, atrophy, because the way you explained antidepressants in relation to it, it's more of a crutch where you're constantly needing to take this over and over again. And with these, it sounds like, if anything, it's giving you not a crutch, but more like a cast to slowly come out of the fog that you've been in. Am I sort of putting it in layman's terms?
Yeah, I mean you're hitting an important piece here. I think it's important to note that antidepressants are actually a really important piece of the, mental health tool belt that we have. It's a great intervention for people who are, maybe in a really dark place or unstable and just need something that can put them in a zone of comfort so that their system isn't overwhelmed and, bad things don't happen. But what it does, the way that I kind of see the antidepressants and SSRIs, it puts that sort of floor in, right? So your mood doesn't drop below the floor. Your sense of self doesn't drop below the floor, but it also creates a ceiling. And so you don't experience the modulation of emotions of, joy, and you don't experience the pain or sorrow as much. So people tend to like live in this sort of numbed out experience on SSRIs. And so when I say it's a good intervention, it's good for a short period of time, but long term, over the course of years, decades, you start to see the cost of it being that you don't experience the highs and lows of life. You live a very modulated experience, and that kind of sucks a little bit. It's hard to live your life and realize that you've missed out on the highs and lows. So, psilocybin, what I see is that because it's going directly to the source of the depression, is that it neither creates a floor nor a ceiling, but it just raises the baseline of happiness. So instead of being down here and needing to protect yourself from down here, you're up, maybe up here, and your lows can still get pretty low, but like you're at a higher baseline. And so, we see like big dose experience might be called a therapeutic dose, experience with mushrooms, is great for, kind of going in, having a big neuroplasticity event, recharging the brain, infusing it with a compound that helps create a bunch of neuroplasticity in the brain and can really like break those patterns of thought, beliefs, attachments to help you form a new, healthier relationship with yourself, which you then see as, kind of the new resourcing that you were talking about. It's like they're more resourced. They have the fishing pole now. They're not like being taught how to fish. And then there's microdosing, right? And microdosing is one of those things that you can take regularly, semi-regularly, but it's also really good to take some time off. So, some microdosing protocols say like be on a microdosing protocol for 3 months and then take some time off. It's good for the brain to come back into a normalized detox kind of state and find a new baseline. So it's I think long-term use isn't, you get to a point with these medicines where you're like, I don't really need them. I feel pretty good, you know, and through the experiences of engaging with psychedelics, you just gain new tools for self-regulation, emotional regulation, you know, the way that you relate to yourself, the way you relate to the world, all of those functions that are necessary to have a healthy life, become a part of your experience inherently. So the substances then aren't really necessary, and you can just go on doing the things that you want to do, and you're just, you know, more healthy and regulated.
No, that's great. I mean, I didn't even think of it like that. Obviously, I've heard it kind of like opening people's eyes or really like digging deep on, you know, like past trauma or stuff like that. But I never thought of it like that. That's awesome. Working as a transformative coach or even psychedelic guy, what are kind of like, I would imagine you have to start a basis, like a starting point from where you go. What's the process like? From how do you go through a process with someone who's like brand new?
Well, there's always going to be a screening process, right? I mean, these substances hold a lot of great promise, and there's also risk associated. So you got to like screen for various different things that might be red flags or maybe not red flags that totally exclude you from being able to do this, but just so that you kind of know what's going to be a part of the process moving forward, things that you need to pay attention to throughout the rest of the process. So that screening and intake is really important. You know, we'll talk about like what medications you might be on. And if you're on medications, I always recommend that people talk to their primary care physician or the prescribing physician to make sure that the drug interaction isn't going to be toxic, and kind of check like, you know, those boxes first, those basic safety boxes. And then we kind of get into, and we'll talk about like, well, what's sort of drawing you to this experience, and why do you want to engage this? You know, a lot of it in that sort of exploratory process is like, you know, is this something that you're coming to because you want to take seriously, or is this something that you're coming to, you know, because you know, it's the new thing on the block and you know, you want to experience it and it's a lot of fun and yada, yada, yada. The intention that people use to step into these spaces is really important. So there's a little bit of coaching in there. And if people are really rigid around like, you know, like kind of a mindset or a mind frame that like, this is going to solve all their problems, it's usually not the person that I want to work with. I want somebody who can sort of understand that this isn't a silver bullet. It's actually, you know, it's the start of something. It's like, you know, you're starting at zero and you need to work forward from there. And so then we get into kind of the preparation process, and the preparation looks, you know, it's very dependent upon the individual and where the individual is at and kind of their relationship with their self and their awareness of themselves and the things that they're struggling with, working with. And so I'll do like a little bit of a, you know, a sort of question and exploration around the facets or the pieces in their lives that are maybe causing pain or causing separation or maybe frustrating or overwhelming. And within each of those little areas, there's information for me about this person and what they're more deeply wrestling with. And so then the process is about continuing to peel back those layers of awareness. The preparation process is peeling those back to get to some place of kind of like a deeper awareness, a sort of center point. You could call it the wound. You could call it a trauma. You know, it might even look a little bit different than that, but we're really trying to get to some proximity to the underlying malady that's causing some ripple effects of discomfort or pain in somebody's life, and then you get into the facilitated experience, and the facilitated experience after you've gone through that process, you know, is all about supporting the deeper healing that needs to occur in order to move through that part.
Yeah. So the way I see that is like, I guess you got to get all the shrapnel out, and obviously it's going to be a bloody process. But after that, I would imagine like once it's out in the air, by the way, do they get to see a video of themselves? I mean, are they cognizant of all they say usually?
It depends on the individual. Some people have a really great ability to remember, you know, the lion's share of their experience. Some people, they don't have any real memory of it. And I think that like shrapnel metaphor is like accurate in a way. It is like picking those pieces out to allow like all the wounds to heal, you know. But, you know, you get to the facilitated experience and it looks different for some people. For some people, it's a really somatic experience where they're feeling very much in their body. And for some people, it's a very mental experience where they're seeing like a story sort of play out in like movie format, where they're watching maybe the story of their life unfold and seeing it in a different way. If that memory disappears and they don't have a memory of it, I always tell people like, that's fine. You don't need to remember the experience in order for it to impact you. In fact, sometimes it can be a real distraction. This is where you get into the most important part of the experience, which is the integration. So everything that comes after the experience, I think, is real, where the real work begins.
No, and that's what I was going to touch upon. I mean, like, once you get the shrapnel out, that's the part where like you've got the lice, like you've got the therapist, and they've already like, this is what's bothering me. This is like what I've pushed down for the longest time. I never talk about it. And it's like that thing in the back of your mind that you're just like, I can't talk about this. Like, this is just gonna like I've always put this down. There's no reason for me to bring this up. It's like when people paint over top of so many times, you know, like they've had the house like 20 times and they finally peel back the like bottom layer and it's just rotted. And that's what I imagine. It's just like, this is what it is.
Yeah. And like, to use that analogy, it's almost as though, like, you know, it's like people painted over it and every single layer rotted and they just keep putting new wallpaper over top of it. But like underneath all of the rot is like the gold, you know, flake wall that's like divine and precious. And so people begin to cut through it and they get to the rot and they're like, oh, I don't want to go any further. Like, I don't want to change this wall out. And they stop before they get to the real gold. And I think what psychedelics do is it like takes you to the place where you strip away a lot of layers and get down to the gold. And maybe the whole wall isn't totally stripped away, but you can at least see down to the deepest layer that there's gold. And so then the work of integration is about continuing to strip back all of those layers so the rest of the wall
is exposed. I really like that metaphor. You can see the gold. You kind of see like into that window of what, like, no, I like that. That's really cool. I'm a visual person, so I have to kind of, and I hope that people who are listening are visual like me, and that kind of helps paint a picture with some of these details. There's people who, you know, have misconceptions, and you know, the people who are like, oh, they're just using it to get high. Like, what do you tell those kind of people who bring, maybe there's proponents against that in Colorado who voted against it, or there's people who even come into, I wouldn't imagine that they come into it, like come to you on the journey just because you, just like you said, you don't want a person coming in there who's like completely closed off. Like, that just, I would imagine that would be like one of the worst experiences ever. Like, you're trying to fight against something that you don't even believe in. That's just, you know, like, I don't know. It's like going on a sailboat without a sail. It's just like, what's the point? Where I'm not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you see like the classical sort of, you know, mechanism of the mind in that regard is like people who are extremely neurotic and controlling, you know, they come in and they're like, I want to experience this. I've heard it's an amazing experience, but they're not willing to like get into the, you know, the deeper exploration of it. And the way that you see that manifest in a facilitated experience is that people will get to the, you know, the journey will take them somewhere. The medicine will take them somewhere that's fundamentally uncomfortable for them. And then they'll try to start to control the experience. And some people are really skilled at controlling the experience, and they might totally shut down the psychedelic experience altogether. So they might not, you know, you could give them a bunch of, you know, their medicine, and they might not have an experience, a psychedelic experience at all. But then some people who are less in that tight control, but still controlling, what they might experience is their neuroticism playing out. And it's kind of like being on a sailboat in the middle of the ocean and a hurricane's rolling through. You know, there's no way to move out of that experience. There's no way to like find refuge. There's no way to like get safe passage. You just kind of got to wait out the storm. And sometimes there's gifts in that. There's often gifts in that, but it's just really hard on the individuals who experience it, and really hard on me. And so, you know, I think it's really, I'm a proponent of recreational use. I think it's like, you know, a good stepping stone to get there, to get to like a deeper dose or a deeper experience, more therapeutic experience. Cause it kind of just, it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. You know, you get to kind of like get a sense of how it works, what you see, get a sense of the visuals. You can kind of relax into the experience for the most part, if you're in the right place at the right time. There's a term called set and setting. So being in the right mindset and doing this in the right setting is really important. So I'm not advocating for, like, you know, going to some, you know, heavy metal concert and taking a recreational dose of mushrooms. But like, if you're just, you know, at home or in a safe space, and, you know, you've got people around you who can support you, it can be a really great entry point into experiencing what psychedelics are. And then it just creates a better understanding of what you might experience within a therapeutic setting, which is the, you know, the iceberg that's below the surface.
Yeah, no, that I definitely see. And the imagery of the iceberg, I mean, that's perfect, because I feel like they always use that for ego and id and, you know, what's going on underneath. I know there's, you know, confidentiality and HIPAA and all that stuff, but can you share like a really good success story?
I mean, one of my favorites that's on the front of my mind right now is, you know, this was a client that I worked with at a distance. I had a friend who, his sister-in-law had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, right? And she had lost all control of everything below her neck. She could talk, she could blink, she couldn't move. And so I was a part of the preparation and integration process and sort of coached through the ceremonial experience. And you know, it's a disease that's set on over the course of 2 years. And so, you know, you kind of go from like being fully able-bodied to having absolutely no control of motor function in the span of 2 years, which is traumatic, you know, in and of itself. And so she did this journey, and you know, she had a lot of revelations that are very personal. But she, you know, came into acceptance, a deeper acceptance of her station in life and the circumstances of her life. And I don't know if it's really easy to articulate what peace of mind is, you know, when you are literally, you know, just waiting for your life to end. And you know, she experienced a lot of relief, and I think the beauty of that is like, you know, you get to that point, and the most important thing in your life is family and connection, and just being able to be present with your family and not so wrapped up in why did this happen to me, you know, why me, is that just gets in the way of being able to cherish those precious moments at the end of your life. So you know, that's an intense story, you know. That's like one of the successes. I mean, I've worked with 180 people over the course of the last 5 years, and I would say there's 180 success stories by and large, and each one of them looks different in a lot of ways, but the essence of them is that people are just more present with their life, and that just leads to a more loving connection with themselves and their loved ones and the world around them.
That's awesome that you've seen that much. Wow, 180 every 5 years. That's about what is that, like 30 every year? Is that kind of how much you do in a year, close to it?
When I got started, it was a smaller number. So I guess about 4.5, 5 years ago, I think I probably did 10 the first year, maybe 20 the next year, and then the lion's share of them have come in the last 3 years. So probably closer to 40, 50, maybe.
Wow. So, man, that's pretty like that's pretty busy. That's awesome. So it's like one a week basically.
On average,
That's nice. So
yeah.
I guess if somebody wanted to dip their toes, and obviously, I mean, it's big in Colorado, and there's a couple other states I would imagine that are getting laws in order, the same stuff as Colorado. How would you have individuals interested kind of to explore psychedelics? I mean, not just for therapeutic or growth. How would they, and I know you mentioned this too, like in a safe space to try it, but is there anything else you would recommend to kind of have them to gain more information on it?
I think we're living in a time right now where there's so much academic research that's coming out, and two anecdotal stories. I think the anecdotal stories in a lot of ways are more valuable, depending on the story, of course. There's a lot of upsides to this space and to these medicines, and there's also a lot of downsides. So I would seek out both, positive stories and seek out the stories of negative experiences and see how these stories kind of affect you in your body. Does it make you excited? Does it make you fearful? And then let that kind of guide the curiosity of where people want to go. But I do think it's valuable to have some kind of a background and understanding of one, why you're curious about it, why the individual's curious about it, how that curiosity relates to all of the academic and otherwise, research areas of this space, and then also to the anecdotal stories. And get to a place where you have some intention for what is driving that curiosity. Is it that you want to heal? Is it that you just want to explore? Is it that you want to kind of be a psychedelic tourist and go down to Costa Rica and have this like jungle experience down there with ayahuasca or psilocybin? And we're moving into a place where these medicines are going to be more accessible in various different settings too. So, for instance, like in Oregon passed a legal framework back in 2021 or 2022, I think. And last year was the first year that it was operating. And so people can fly in from all over the country and go and experience those in a clinical setting. Now there's upside to a clinical setting for sure, but there's also like some weird, funky, like downsides to it that you could be doing it in like a really sterile environment. And that might not be the right setting. Like the right setting might be that you find a retreat center in the mountains of Colorado and want to go experience them in, a wooded forest and connect with nature. Or maybe you want to go down to Costa Rica and have more of like a jungly ocean, communal kind of vibe. And so there's more and more options coming online, and to be thoughtful about what really works for you and what really is calling to you. For some people, the safest place they're going to be is in a therapeutic setting. For some people, it's going to be somewhere else. And so that's a little bit of an exploration thing. So if anybody's listening to this and wants to kind of figure out what's going to be right for them, these are conversations that I love to have. And it's something that I enjoy kind of parsing out for people.
And that's great. My next question was, where do you see it going from here? And you kind of touched on that. Is there anything else that you see down the line, let's say in like 10 years? Obviously more availability, but anything I'm missing?
Right now, I think one of the biggest pieces that is going to impact the direction that all this goes is the scheduling of these substances. So I know that there's a big movement to reschedule these psychedelic compounds, psilocybin, even MDMA, or, you know, it's on the streets called ecstasy or Molly. Like each of those are, you know, to be in a Schedule One substance, you have to have no medical benefits and extremely addictive. Like those are the criteria that these substances have to have. And everything is showing that like these substances are very therapeutic and perhaps addictive, but not like the classical addictive substances like heroin and methamphetamine. So when that happens, and I think that will probably happen over the next probably 3 to 5 years, we're gonna see the landscape of psychedelic, you know, call it medicine, start to shift and change. And it might be something that, you know, these states begin to open up treatment centers where people can just go and do these in a clinical setting, much like you can with ketamine. There's ketamine clinics. Ketamine's a legally accessible substance that can be prescribed. And so I think people are going to go that direction. But ultimately, I think people are going to realize that, in my opinion, the best way to experience these substances is somewhere around nature, especially the plant medicine, somewhere around nature, and especially in communal settings. So that will look like retreat centers where people are gathered in a community to ingest these medicines and heal as a community. And then, you know, we're just kind of getting to the tip of the iceberg with how it's going to show up that way. But there, it's going to fundamentally change. I mean, my 100,000 foot view on this is that it's going to fundamentally change the way that we relate in society. And so I think systems of organization, communal systems, communities themselves are going to start to shift and evolve towards a more connected, you know, human to human nature rather than sort of an individualistic one-to-one nature like traditional talk therapy or even like isolated friend group and friend settings one-to-one. It's going to be much more rich in the way that we engage with one another.
I guess we were digging into like just cracking open like not our psyche but kind of like what's deep down, and I guess sometimes you just can't even scratch that with, you know, like what we've been doing for the last 10 or 20 years. So my last question that I usually like to wrap up with is, what is something that your parents did that you'd like to pass on to a next generation? And what is something new or different that you would do?
One of the greatest gifts of my childhood was that I was raised in a small town where my aunts and uncles lived and my grandparents lived, and my family and my cousins kind of all grew up together. And there was like a real, you know, it moved beyond the nuclear family unit and, you know, the sort of communal unit of the family, really impacted me. And I think it really inspired me. I mean, I grew up in Illinois, but all of my siblings live here in Denver. And so I think we're all sort of living that. And it's such a beautiful thing. So I've got a chance to get to do this with my siblings, and my mom also lives here too. And so shit, it's happening. What I wouldn't do, or what I would do differently, let's put it that way. Yeah. I would put more emphasis on individuality and the freedom of expression. And I would do my own deep inner work to make sure that I'm not projecting my expectations onto my kids.
I like that. That's good. Yeah. A strong thread I've seen people is mental health. And obviously, you know, like the last generation and the generation before it are from completely different technology, wars, you know, like depression. Well, sorry, when I say depression, I mean both depressions on a financial and a mental level, where depression wasn't a thing. It was just a feeling of sadness. But yeah, no, mental health is always a good driver on the last question. And just to wrap it up, is there anything that you want to get on your soapbox and scream out that you're working on or that listeners can follow up on?
Yeah, I mean, I have an established practice, Denver, Colorado, My practice is transformational coaching, psychedelic guiding, men's work. I just launched a free online men's group that's available to anyone all over the country. It's entry level. It's going to be hosted every third Wednesday of the month. And it's just a place for men to show up in a vulnerable space and gain support from peers and people who can help guide them. And, you know, it's a space to work on the things that challenge us in our life. And I'm really passionate about that. And my coaching practice and my transformational coaching practice is essentially, I've taken the 7 years of experience that I have with psychedelics and all of the insights and methodologies that I've gained through working with people in that space. And I've kind of condensed it down into a coaching environment, coaching package that level utilizes all the resources there. And I can, you know, help people at any stage of their life move through the challenges that they're facing in their life, hopefully to, you know, step into the next chapter of whatever is really meant for them. And so that's all, you know, without the help of psychedelics, but it's, in my mind, it's can be just as powerful as long as people are committed. And then, yeah, you can find me on Instagram. My Instagram is James Eshelman, all one word, James Eshelman. And my website is centeroftheallddirections.com.
Perfect. And I'll attach a link, everybody listening, so they can easily get to it. But yeah, thank you very much. It was just like I said at the start of the interview, I am a different person than I was when we started. And it just kind of expanded my mind, which is kind of ironic. But yeah, thanks again for being on the show. I had fun. I hope you had fun.
I had a blast, man. I love talking about this stuff, and felt like you know, just such an engaging conversation to get to share with your listeners. So thanks for having me.
If you like this week's episode of People More Interesting Than Me, please follow me on Apple Podcasts so you won't miss out on more episodes like these.